Okay, so just a reminder about exam one coming up a week from today. It'll be at 8 a.m. and class will go on normally that day. Here, the exam is actually going to be in Bausch & Lomb 109, which you have to keep in mind. Okay, in terms of material, basically it's up until I started talking about capacitors, which means basically through chapter 25 material, which I think was about page 6 of last lecture, or through workshop 3, problem set 4. There's one last problem on problem set 4, which I think was starting capacitors, so that one isn't on there. Calculator is okay. Past exams are now on the web, including 2008. You're welcome to bring this 3.5-inch index card with anything you want on it. You can have formulas. You can have integrals, you can have small prayers, anything that you think works for you, nice poems to calm you down. The problem sets that you've turned in already are now in a box outside of my office door, which I should have brought here but just didn't think to at the last moment. At any rate, you can pick them up there at your leisure. The grades have been recorded. Remember, the spirit of that is if you made a reasonable attempt on whichever random problem was picked, you should get your 1 point on that. There were 2 papers that had been handed in with no name on them. So clearly, you should look. Those are on the top, and you should look. And if you have one of those papers, you should write your name on it and slip it under my office door so that I can get the grade recorded properly on Blackboard. Okay? Any questions about any of this stuff? All right. So last time, we looked at a particularly useful geometry to know about, which would be an infinite sheet of charge. Kill the word current here. This isn't a current sheet. We'll see current sheets, but we're not seeing them currently. Sorry. Oh boy, that didn't work at all. Infinite sheet of charge. Okay. So just an infinite sheet of charge. Obviously, that means you have an infinite charge and you'll have an infinite energy in this problem, so it's a little bit unphysical in that way. But you can use Gauss's law and actually solve for the electric field, which is very nicely behaved and constant and depends only on this charge density. So this turns out to be a really useful thing that we'll run into a lot. And although you may think, okay, that's really unphysical, so of what earthly use is it? Well, if I have actually a flat surface with charge on it, when you get close enough to that surface, it looks infinite. So this is in the limit of being close to any sort of flat surface. This is a very useful thing to know about. You can take 2 of these, one positive, one negative, and put them a distance d apart. And what you find is that, remember, this field for this single sheet goes infinitely far that way, infinitely far that way. When you have 2 of them in close proximity, in any proximity, the electric field which comes from the 2 of them is a vectorial superposition of the 2, which means the field from the left-hand sheet here, which in this region is moving to the right, cancels exactly with the field which is coming from the right-hand sheet in this region is moving to the right instead of to the left. And so those cancel exactly. So the field is 0 here, it's 0 here, and it is constant and of magnitude sigma over epsilon naught in the middle. So this now is a way of creating a very well understood and uniform electric field, which is something that we can use in lots of examples and things where we're trying to understand effects on electric fields. So it's a good thing to keep in mind, these geometries. Then we started something a little bit new. We looked at a few geometries and saw that the potential difference between different pieces of a system was proportional to the amount of charge that was on those pieces in the system. And we make up a constant of proportionality using a symbol that we try to use at least once in every class for something new, which is known as the capacitance. And so this basic little formula is one that you'll just be using out the wazoo. So Q is equal to CV should just start coming out all the time out of your mouth. If somebody says Q, you should scream CV. Okay. So capacitance, the MKS unit, is called the farad. A farad of charge, of capacitance, is actually really big. So very often you'll see microfarads and millifarads if you're actually doing something in the lab. You can mentally think of a capacitor as something like this. In a circuit, you can have the circuit hooked across something like this set of parallel plates. And this turns out to be a nice reservoir of charge. And in fact, even physically, if you were making a capacitor to go in a circuit, I mean, one of the ways you might make it is to take two little thin pieces of conductor and put them close together and add conducting leads to it, and that's what you hook up in your circuit. So this really isn't a bad mental model to have when you hear the word capacitor or capacitance. Certainly, as you get to larger capacitors, the geometry and the things may be very different, but that's not a bad mental model to have. This relationship is actually very general, although we derived it for a particular example. We looked at a particular example where we derived the capacitance for a system where you have two charged plates, plus Q on one side, minus Q on the other, separated by a distance D, and they have area A. If you put a potential difference across them, last time we derived what the capacitance was in terms of that, and it was this quantity, epsilon naught A over D, which is geometric only. And in fact, that's a general rule about capacitance as well. It only depends on the actual geometry of the system. You okay with that? Any questions? Okay, and then to end class last time, because very often you have more than one capacitor in a problem, or you have to deal with it. Those capacitors can be hooked up in any arbitrary combination of capacitors can be broken down into thinking of them in terms of being hooked up in terms of series or parallel. I mean, you may break down different pieces and think of them as in series or parallel and work your way out. So it can be a complex business, but in general, you can deconstruct any sort of combination of capacitors knowing the relationship of what is the total capacitance for capacitors that are hooked up in series and hooked up in parallel. And we derived the relationship for capacitors in series. The relationship is reciprocal for that. And in parallel, it's linear. Okay? This is clearly, okay, we got to use the word, it's trivial, right? Especially for a mathematical class like this. The one gotcha you'll get is that shortly we'll be doing resistors, and when we do resistors, we will find a linear relationship when they're in series and the reciprocal relationship when they're in parallel. So that's the gotcha. If you're doing resistors, don't think capacitors, and if you're doing capacitors, don't think resistors, and you should be good. Okay? And there is a trick when we get to resistors that I use to remember those if I don't have them written down somewhere. Although, as trivial as these formulas are, I will throw them on the formula sheet. So if you have to jog your memory as to whether you go linear for series or for resistors or capacitors, you can always go and check. You good with that? Okay, so now what I'd like to do is to turn toward energy in capacitors and think about that a bit. So let us imagine that we have a circuit where we have an EMF And now, because capacitors and EMFs look fairly similar, you need to start being a little bit careful how you draw them in the circuits, right? If you start drawing your capacitors with one line that's carelessly drawn a little short, you're gonna get yourself very confused after a while. So what I would like to do is to consider a circuit where we have some sort of capacitor and a battery, and we have a little switch, okay? And so initially, although we have a potential difference across these two wires, we've broken the connector here. So what really happens is that you have no charge that will flow here when you hook things up, because charge is like water. It won't flow unless it has somewhere to flow, basically. So at this point, you have no charge on your capacitor at all. So then what I'd like to do is to throw the switch. And now I'm making a little bit of a... We're violating something that we've had in place since we started. We've been doing electrostatics, and things are going to get a little fuzzy right now because we're actually going to look a little bit at time dependence, but I'd like to think of things as happening very slowly right now. So it's a little bit time dependent, but don't let that bother you at the moment, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I want to take this and I want to throw the switch. So we have a plus charge here and a minus charge here, but I made this too long, so there. And here's our circuit. We have the capacitor here. And now you can imagine that charge begins to flow on this circuit, because basically what the EMF does is it has either a mechanical or a chemical process or something that actually separates charge onto its two terminals. And if you have a whole lot of positive charge sitting here and you give it a place to go, it'll basically push the charge off and spread it out on this conductor. So you can imagine that right at first you'll have a little bit, a DQ, I'll call it DQ prime, which starts moving over to the capacitor. Or at any given moment, you can imagine that you have a DQ prime moving over to the capacitor, and what I'd like to do is to consider the capacitor at the time that it has a Q prime on it. And Q prime is going to be equal to C times V prime. So in the limit that we haven't fully charged this thing to total, this EMF, let's say, has a potential V. So I call this EMF a little scripty. You'll see it sometimes as a V. I'm going to call it a V because we've been using Q equals CV, but those are really interchangeable. So I will interchange them as appropriate to keep you confused. So we're going to now let the DQs go over to this capacitor. And what I'd like to do is to think about that process a bit and actually calculate how much total work it takes to move that charge over to the capacitor. So if we think of this situation where the capacitor has some amount of charge, Q prime, sitting on it already, and ask how much work does it take to move this DQ over to that capacitor, it'll be a differential amount of work because it's a differential amount of charge. So dW. Remember, what do we mean when we say what is the potential? It means the work per unit charge. So the amount of work it takes to move it over to the other side is going to be V prime times T Q prime. I think it may be a little bit fuzzy to sort of think about it the way I just presented it. Maybe it's a better way to think about it is at this given time, how much work does it take to move a little bit of charge from here over to this other side at that moment, if you wanted to think about it that way. The charge really isn't moving there, but that would be a measure of how much work it takes to actually move the charge. So this sort of makes more sense if you think about it that way. But in, yeah. Because at the moment that I have V prime across these plates, this is by definition true if you think about it that way. But it also is sort of... If you have some positive charge here, it is going to take some work to move this over here. And so that's also what we're trying to say here. So dW is equal to V is Q prime is equal to C V prime, and we have V prime, so this is Q prime over C dQ prime. And now I can calculate the, if I now ask what is the total work to charge the capacitor up to its total charge, which will be big Q is equal to the capacitance times V, which is the ultimate potential difference I can have. See, eventually what happens is I will move charge over to this point until I have a potential difference V here, which is the same as across here. Or, yeah. And at that point, charge content stops flowing, and you say that the capacitor is fully charged. So the total work is going to be the integral from 0 to total charge Q of Q prime over C dQ prime. And this is going to, the integral of Q prime is Q squared over 2. So this becomes 1 over C times Q squared over 2. And then remember that Q squared is CV, so this is also equal to 1 over C times C squared V squared over 2, or 1 half CV squared. And that's really what I was after, the amount of total amount of work it takes, which is the energy to charge a capacitor, which is often symbolized by U, is equal to 1 half CV squared. You can use the relationship between Q and CV to rewrite this. So you can get this to be 1 half Q squared over C. And I guess there's a third way we can do it. So I have written it. So we now want to, I've written it in terms of C and V. I've written it in terms of Q and C. So if I want to get rid of C, then I take the 1 half CV squared, substitute in for C, which is Q over V. So this is equal to 1 half Q over V, V squared, which is going to be 1 half QV. Did I do that right? Okay. So these are useful forms to have. The one that I always remember is 1/2 CV squared, because it's sort of like 1/2 MV squared, and it just sort of sticks for me personally. So this is now the energy that it takes to charge up a capacitor. Which, if it takes that energy to charge it up, then it also means that this is the energy stored in the capacitor. Where is that energy? I mean, in a spring, if I stretch a spring, you can sort of think about where that energy is in terms of the potential energy of the spring, and you have mechanically sort of changed the lattice or whatever to the point where it's going to pull you back. What's going on here? Where's the energy?
There's a deficit balance in the electric field between the two plates that causes the charges to jump.
Hopefully the charges aren't jumping, because then that would break down. But yeah, as you build the charge up on the two plates, you also are building up the strength of this electric field. Okay? And remember, this whole weird electric field thing, we started out sort of as, let's make up an electric field, right? Because it's sort of convenient. And now, if you look at the system, I mean, you don't really have energy stored in the charge per se, you're just dumping charge there. I mean, maybe you can argue that you're putting a lot of charge close to itself, so you have potential energy building up. But in our mental picture with the electric field, as you put more and more charge here, you get a stronger and stronger electric field in here. So that's what you're establishing between these plates. And so that's where the energy is stored. That's the picture that I'd like you to think about. So what I'd like to do now is within that picture, I'd like to actually think about what is the energy density of the electric field. And I would like to use it in this parallel plate system, because that's one where we actually understand a lot about the geometry. So if we imagine I have a plus Q over here and a minus Q over here, we will have an electric field between these plates. And we know all about how that electric field and sigma and things are related. So, and we know about the capacitance, so we can analyze this system. So let's imagine that we have an energy density of the electric field, which, when I use three lines like that, that's my symbol for is defined as. Okay, just so you know, that's my shorthand. I forget to tell you these things. So the energy density in the electric field is defined as, and I'll use sort of a script U with a subscript E. So that is the symbol I'm going to use to define the energy density of the electric field. So we can calculate the energy density of the electric field in this particular geometry. If we look at the total energy, and divide it by the total volume between the plates. And we just calculated, for a system of parallel plates like this, if we ignore the fringe fields, we just calculated the energy stored in a capacitor, which is 1/2 CV squared. So this is 1/2 CV squared. And if we assume the plates have an area A, then the volume between the plates will be the distance d times the area of the plates, okay? And earlier, we discovered that the capacitance of parallel plates was equal to the area times epsilon naught over d. So this piece then becomes 1/2. Let's substitute in for the capacitance, so this becomes area epsilon naught over D times V squared over D times A. Okay? And so the D's cancel. Oops, wrong color. So this cancels with that. The A's add.
The D becomes V squared.
Oh, never mind. Yeah, I was thinking of them as numbers. I can't do numbers, but symbols I should do better on. Yeah, so I've even got it written down here. I guess I could use my notes. So this becomes epsilon naught V squared over 2D squared. Right, so the A's cancel. All right, so this is equal to epsilon naught. What is V? Remember that the potential difference across parallel plates is equal to E times D. So this becomes the magnitude of E squared times D squared over 2D squared, or epsilon naught over 2 E squared. So this is a very particular geometry that we use to get this, but what are we deriving? We are deriving the energy density of electric field. There's no fundamental difference between the essence of an electric field that's formed from being in parallel plates than in any other way. The geometry may be different. I said, or you know, the field might change in strength, or it might change with some direction. But basically, this is a property of the electric field that we derived. We just used this particular geometry so that we could actually do it. So this is now a very fundamental and important relationship. There is energy in the electric field, okay, and it goes as the square of the magnitude of that electric field. So I think now, well, so we took our little fictitious field and now we're starting to attribute some pretty interesting things to it for being such a fictitious thing. It actually has energy by itself. So this is a general result. Ooh. In spite of the fact that I can't write that. Okay. You all right with that? So now what that means is if you have any sort of problem and you analyze the electric field like a Gauss's law problem, you can also determine how much energy is stored in that system by virtue of knowing what the electric field is and using this as the energy density being stored in the electric field. So basically taking the energy density and then integrating the electric field over the geometry. So let's imagine that you have just some system. So we have some sort of internal chunk here which has a rho as a function of R, and then we can have some shell out here, and you can now calculate with this, with Gauss's law or whatever, that you have an electric field in here and an electric field prime here and an electric field double prime here and an electric field triple prime here, and all of these may have some radial dependence. And if you want to now calculate the total energy, the total energy U is equal to the integral over the volume of the system times the energy density over the volume. So you just integrate the energy density. Well, the energy density is a couple of constants times E squared. So if you have now calculated E in all of these regions, then you can do an integral of E squared, carrying the constants right, over that entire volume, or whatever the appropriate volume is, to determine how much energy is stored there. All right? You okay with that? Any questions? I mean, I'm not going to bother with an example on that. We'll cover that on the exam. Just kidding. Gosh, you guys don't have a sense of humor today. All right, I guess it's the weather. Yeah. That's going to make for a long winter. You're going to have to learn to smile when it's raining. Yes. Yeah, if the electric field is constant, you have a constant energy density, and then all you have to do is multiply that energy density by the volume, and you get the total energy. Yeah. Okay, so up until now, we have been talking about the case where we considered the electric field in a vacuum. I mean, we did talk about, suppose you have some sort of crud and distribute charge in a certain way, but we sort of ignored the existence of the crud other than the fact that it held the charge in place for the distribution that you've got. And it's true that conductors are materials, so we did sort of think about those. But what I'd like to do now is to consider electric fields in materials. So there are a couple of things that I have to tell you about. First of all, as a physicist, initially you really don't like this because we have engineers for that. Right? What you like to do is to sort of think pretty fundamental stuff and see how it all fits together. And you know, you let the engineers deal with the muck of the real world. The problem is that it's hard to do anything without running into the muck of the real world. So if you actually want to do an experiment, you're gonna have to deal with it. And many of you will probably end up working on things which involve the muck of the real world, where you're doing fundamental solid-state physics or chemistry or biology or whatever. I mean, biology is a bunch of chemicals, and chemistry is a bunch of charges. It's basically quantum mechanics with electrostatics thrown in, and that's more or less what it is. I mean, that's what a dog is. Now you have to be. I mean, you can't solve a dog using Coulomb and quantum mechanics yet, but fundamentally, from a physicist's point of view, that's the essence of what it is. But if you're trying to get down to it, given that that's what it is, you have no choice to try to understand anything. For example, in biology, you want to understand how a protein folds or whatever, that protein's in a solution. Dogs are mostly water, right? So you actually really can't get away from understanding electric fields in materials if you really want to do anything much with it, okay? So as much as it greatly pains me, we have no choice but to get our hands a little bit dirty with this. Okay, the second thing I want to tell you is that it is far too obvious what it is that you're talking about if you talk about electric fields in materials, right? So we have to make up a new word, and the word is dielectrics. So we will talk about electric fields in dielectrics or dielectric materials. What you really mean when you say a dielectric material is a non-conductor and not a vacuum. So it's pretty much everything else, okay? But it's a cool word, so you got to use it. All right, so having said that, before I do this, I'm going to do that. Okay, so let's do a demo. What I have here in the cylinder before me, I have a large capacitor, okay? And at the moment, it should be uncharged, but I have a power supply here that basically has a fixed potential difference across it. There, actually. And what I have here is a voltmeter that measures the potential difference across the capacitor's terminals. And why it says 0.18, I'm not absolutely sure right now. Maybe it's slightly charged, or maybe we have a problem with the zeroing on this thing. But what I want to do first is I want you to see that I have two leads here that connect to two conductors. There's a switch, so when I throw the switch down, I'm connecting to those two conductors, to these two conductors, which go across the two terminals in the capacitor. So what I'm going to do when I throw the switch is we're going to our example problem where we had the EMF and the capacitor and a switch. I close the switch and charge will flow. As the charge flows, you're going to see this thing charge up. Before long, we'll actually be looking at the time dependence of that, but for now, you can just appreciate the beauty of the time dependence of it without fretting over exactly how many milliseconds it took to do that or whatever. So here we go. And you can see that the potential difference across these plates is changing. And as more and more charge goes on the plates, the rate of change is going to drop. In other words, it's getting harder. And initially, you have a big potential difference across the EMF. And nothing here. So basically the charge flows pretty fast. But as the charge flows and you get the charge here so that the potential difference is equalized to what you have over here, it flows less and less fast. Okay, so the potential difference here, the rate of change is very fast initially and then it slows down. So you just saw that. And now what I want to do is remove it from the EMF. And when I do that, you'll see the potential difference across the capacitor terminals actually is pretty stable. It's dropping slightly because some of the charge will actually bleed out into the atmosphere, especially if it's a humid day. So you might lose a little bit slowly. But now what we have is this capacitor with all this charge on the plates, and we have a lot of energy stored in the system in the form of the electric field. And we have a big potential difference across these. So now what I would like to do is to connect the terminals of the capacitor across a flash bulb. Okay? Just to demonstrate the fact that the capacitor is storing energy. Okay? All right. So it's sort of bright. So we're going to do this. All right, so you ready? You might not want to stare directly at this thing. All right. See? Energy. That was it. It takes energy to do that, right? It came from the capacitor. Boy, you're a tough audience. Okay? And note, actually, we didn't even short the thing out.
It didn't actually happen.
Now I'm going to short it out. I mean, it didn't even take that much charge off of this thing. So, all right, so a demonstration of the energy that gets stored in capacitors. Okay. In case you weren't a believer. Okay. So if we're going to consider the effect of materials on electric fields, we need to talk a little bit about materials. And in this topic, we're going to group materials into two different types. One type we will call polar, and the other type we will call nonpolar. And what we mean by a polar material is that it is a material where there is a natural separation of charge within whatever the structure of the material is. So in water, for example, there is a geometry in water. It's H2O, and the chemistry is such that when you look at how the charge is distributed in a water molecule, you will have a bit more negative charge on this side and a bit more positive charge on that side. So this is minus 2. And so it has a natural dipole form, right? It's within the water molecule, it's just a little bit of a natural separation of charge. Lots of materials are like this. And those are materials called polar materials. If you have had much chemistry, this kind of thing is really critical in determining whether materials will dissolve in other materials and things like that. Whether a substance is polar or nonpolar is really important. A nonpolar material, a good example would be carbon tetrachloride is a geometry where you have the carbon in the middle, and then at four points of a tetrahedron that surrounds it, you have chlorine molecules. The chlorines are negative charge, and the carbon has sort of a net positive charge in this. I mean, if you look at where the charge is distributed around this molecule. And this is completely nonpolar. It's completely symmetric. Okay, so that is a classic nonpolar solvent in chemistry, whereas water is a classic polar solvent in chemistry. And these turn out to be really critical in chemistry. It doesn't matter. We're not going to worry about the chemistry any more than that. I just wanted to throw out a couple of examples because we're talking about real materials here. We're going to think of polar substances as just being something that has a natural separation of plus and minus charge in it, and a nonpolar substance is going to be something where you have positive charge and sort of a uniform distribution of the negative charge around it, whereas the net charge in each of these things we'll think of as zero. So all I'm talking about is the separation of charge within whatever it is in the substance. So if we want to consider a polar substance without an applied electric field, what we're going to see is all of these little polar objects They will actually interact a little bit because they each have a little separation of charge, so the positive side of one will sort of attract negative sides of others, and so you have a little bit of that. But at the same time, in any sort of real substance, you also have thermal agitation, right? If you have a non-zero temperature, things are going to be moving a little bit. They'll have a little kinetic energy. So the interaction here isn't so great, and you can think of these little pieces as being oriented randomly. And we say that we have an inherent dipole here. And that these have random orientations. And if we look at the nonpolar substance, you're going to have a lot of these similar beasts around, but they don't have any net dipole, so there's really not much interaction at all electrostatically. They're just, again, sort of random in the solution or whatever it is. Now what I'd like to do is to consider what happens if we apply an external electric field to this substance. So if we have an external electric field, and we ask what happens to these little inherent dipoles in a polar material, well, if I have an electric field has an orientation, it also exerts a force on the charges in the material. This electric field is going to exert a force on this positive charge that's to the right and a force on the negative charge that's to the left. So if you have a dipole in an electric field, it will exert a torque on the dipole. So the dipole will tend to be oriented with the electric field. So what will happen if you apply an electric field to a polar material is you will begin to get an alignment not 100%, but you'll begin to get an alignment. So the dipoles So now what happens is all the little dipoles, there'll be a bit of a torque, so they will certainly begin to align along the fields with positive charge going in the direction of the field. But again, you have thermal agitation, so this alignment will not be perfect. So you'll have things, lots of knocking around, which will basically be knocking them out of alignment, and then they'll start to realign and they'll get knocked again. So what will happen is that you'll get some alignment there. In nonpolar materials, if you apply a field, imagine what happens on if we blow up one of these little, if we blow up one of these beasts, just big here. This electric field will actually distort this nonpolar molecule a little bit. The positive charge will be pulled a little bit in one direction, the negative charge will be going in the other direction. And what you'll end up with is something that looks more like this, where you actually get an asymmetry in the charge density, for example. So you can take the if you can imagine having an atom that looks like a ball, right? And you apply a big electric field, you're sort of going to pull some of the negative density over. The atom's probably a bad example, but some big molecule. You'll pull the negative density over a little bit relative to the positive density, and we call this separation an induced dipole. And the degree to which you induce the dipole will depend on the strength of the electric field. Once you have an induced dipole, you'll have something sort of similar. Well, the direction of the induction of the dipole already gives you a natural alignment like you're setting up here, right? Because you get the positive charge moved in the direction of the electric field. So in both cases, you could imagine that the degree of the induced dipole here and perhaps the number of these, even as they're knocking around, will be proportional to the strength of the electric field. The same is true here. You don't have 100% alignment, but the stronger and stronger this field is, the more it overcomes whatever thermal agitation effects are knocking things out of alignment. So you'll get more and more of these dipoles aligned. If you haven't noticed already, this is my symbol for is proportional to, and it's proportional to the strength of E. So when we make a statement like that, also the dipoles, the orientation is a long E, okay? And when we make that statement, there's actually a lot of physics there, okay? Because what I'm saying here is that the degree to which the dipoles are aligned, or the way in which in the material charge gets separated, is a long E and proportional to E. And we call substances like that linear dielectrics. It doesn't matter now whether the substance is polar or nonpolar. In both cases, what you get when you apply an electric field is these dipoles either aligning inherent or inducing the other dipoles, and you get a bit of a separation of charge on a molecular scale. And the degree of that separation of charge really depends on the strength of the electric field. So now I'm going to move away from polar and nonpolar and really just worry about the degree of charge separation. So what I would like to do is to consider what happens if we have a geometry that we basically understand. So I'm going to have parallel plates. And within these parallel plates, I'm going to insert a material. And this material is going to be a linear dielectric. And in black, I'm going to draw the external electric field that we know we have from the two plates, because we have charge on one side and charge on the other. Oh, not in black. Okay, let's do it in black. I'm going to call this EXT, or external electric field. External to the substance. Okay, this is like the electric field that is applied to the substance. And what we'd like to do is to understand what is the electric field inside the substance. So what happens, So if we imagine looking at a tube of the substance. So here's the tube, and I just blow it up, okay? Within this little tube, I'm actually creating induced dipoles or aligning little inherent dipoles, and I end up with something that looks like the following. It's going to align so that the negative side is toward the positive charge of the external field. So I will have a little negative here. Use a different color. I have a little negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive. The net charge in this material hasn't changed, but what you have done is you sort of induce some negative charge on this surface of the material and positive charge on this surface of the material. And now we can ask what happens with that sort of separation of charge inside the substance. Going to do something here, sorry. So you can imagine having this pink region, and now I'm going to draw the electric field that is induced inside the pink region because of the induced charge on the substance. So the fact that I have an uncharged substance, I put it inside this external electric field, that external electric field causes a separation of charge within the substance so that we bring a little positive charge over here, a little negative charge over here, the degree of which is proportional to the electric field strength, the external electric field strength. Now that I have some of this positive charge over here and negative charge over here, I will have an internal electric field in the substance due to that induced charge, which is going back the other way. So I will call this pink field the induced electric field. And that's going to be proportional to the external field strength. All right? And now, if I were to ask, what is the electric field inside this material? It is going to be the vector superposition of the external field that you've applied. Sometimes you might see it as applied electric field. And this internal induced electric field. Okay. This internal piece looks like a parallel plate, so we don't have electric field from it out here or here because the induced charge is such that the charge here and the charge here is the same. Okay. So this field strength generally is certainly going to be bigger than this field strength. So if you now vectorially superimpose these two inside this region, what you see is that the net electric field strength inside this material is reduced. It's in the same direction as it was, but it's now reduced in strength. Charges that we have on these two surfaces we'll call the induced charge. And the field that we put inside, the pink field, we'll call the induced field. So let me just blow this up so it's nice and big now. So what we end up with is an E external. Often this is also written as E0, you'll often see it as. Then we have an electric field that is induced here. So this would be E induced. And in this region, the net electric field is going to be E external plus E induced. But they're added vectorially and they're in opposite directions. So E net is going to be smaller than E external. Okay? Different substances have different ability to be polarized, right? Some substances are very big inherent dipoles, others have small ones. Polar substances have a degree of polarizability. Some of them are more polarizable than others with an external electric field. So what exactly happens here is clearly going to be material dependent. So what you do is you call together your engineer friends and you tell them to go out and test a lot of materials and supply you with a table of how materials vary in terms of their ability to weaken the electric field that's applied to it. So we have this. So what this means is that the electric field, this is my net E in the material, is going to be equal to the external electric field, and we want to weaken it, and we want to weaken it in a linear sort of fashion. Well, we want to weaken it, and we want to use a constant that depends on materials. So we're going to throw in a constant here, which is sort of this script K, kappa, and we're going to call this the dielectric constant. It is going to be greater than 1, and it's going to depend on the material. Okay? Just to get some idea of how big an effect this is, kappa is greater than 1, and for water, for example, which is actually a heavily polar solvent in chemistry, kappa is equal to 80.4. So inside water, if you have an electric field, the field inside the water is a factor of 80 weaker. So it's a big effect. Air, it's not a very big effect. Kappa is 1.00054 for typical air, and I can guarantee you that depends on how humid it is. The vacuum, kappa is 1 exactly, so you don't really think of having a kappa if it's a vacuum. Oil, kappa is 4.5. Okay? So you can go to any sort of handbook, or go to Google dielectric constant and get a table of materials and stuff and what the dielectric constant is to figure out what the effect on the electric field is. So you can have an example where we have parallel plates. Suppose you make a capacitor out of parallel plates with a vacuum, or let's consider air equivalent to a vacuum between them. We know that the external electric field, or the field between those plates, is equal to sigma over epsilon naught. We've already seen that. But now if we insert inside here, filling up this entire region, a dielectric with some kappa, the field inside this thing now, the field inside this capacitor is going to be equal to sigma over epsilon naught, but now the strength is diluted by this factor kappa. Okay? That also means that if you ask how much work does it take to go from one plate to the other, it will take less for the given amount of charge that you've got on it, right? Because I've now weakened the field, and the force I have to exert goes as the field times the charge as I move it across. So if I have a fixed charge on each side and I insert a dielectric, then I have reduced the potential difference between these two plates. If I have a fixed potential difference on the plates because I have them hooked across a battery, and I insert a dielectric, I now have to pull more charge onto the plates in order to have it be the same amount of work to go from one plate to the other because I have this fixed potential difference. So that means that at a fixed potential difference, you can increase the amount of charge that a capacitor holds by inserting a dielectric. So I can guarantee you in that cylinder over there, it's not filled with air. It's probably basically got mylar or some sort of nice little conducting stuff all wrapped up, and then it's embedded in some sort of a dielectric, because with that dielectric in there, you can have it store more charge for the same potential. All right? You're going to have lots of fun mind-twisting problems where, you know, a capacitor is charged to a certain potential removed from the EMF and a dielectric is inserted. What happens to the following quantities? So you'll have to learn to think your way through this. Any questions on this? You all right with this? Oh, okay. You are clearly too comfortable with this. So that means that we need to make up yet another name. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to define kappa times epsilon naught. We're going to make a new symbol and just call that epsilon. And remember that this quantity we called the permittivity of free space. Free space meaning vacuum. This thing we're just going to call the permittivity. Okay? And so you can now, in terms of permittivity, E of above is equal to sigma over epsilon. Now you got to start being careful about dropping or not dropping your little knots here, right? So it now makes a difference. The nice thing about this form is for, and here I'd have to sit and think about it for a few minutes. I believe when you use this form, generally, the equations keep the same form, and epsilon naught becomes epsilon. So it's sort of a nice way of doing it that way. But I'd have to stop and think if that's actually true all the time. But that's what I'm going to say for the moment. Just keep it straight which symbol you're using and how it works. Okay. So the permittivity is a measure of how the material reacts underneath a in an electric field. So lots of things change, though, because let's think, for example, we have a capacitor, so Q is equal to CV, and if we have the thing charged up but not attached to a battery, then if we have we charge it to a certain potential and we don't have it attached to the battery, what we said, sorry, we charge it to a certain potential and then we insert a dielectric. This potential in this thing is going to be dropped because what I've done is I've weakened the electric field between the plates, so it takes less work to move across, so the potential has to be reduced by the factor kappa. At the same time, we can ask, so this is when I have no dielectric, and this is going to be when I have dielectric. The capacitance, has to be increased by a factor kappa because at the same potential I increase the amount of charge that I have. So this becomes kappa times times C, or kappa times epsilon naught A over D, or if you want to use the epsilon A over D. So there's an example where you have a formula for capacitance in terms of geometry, and if you now want to insert the dielectric, that epsilon naught kappa turns into the epsilon. And this form is the same as what you saw earlier, except instead of epsilon naught, you've got epsilon. Okay? I can tell you guys are really excited about this. We don't have a lot of engineers in here, do we? I can tell. Engineers should be very excited by this. All right, so now let me just give you a heads up, not that we're going to do anything with this right now, but it's a huge, huge it's a huge assumption that you have a linear dielectric. It works well, for example, if you have a liquid, because truly, if you have water, for example, in this liquid, you're going to have these atoms in all directions. It has no directionality in the liquid itself. You have the external field, you've got the dipoles free to align, and everything's good, okay? If you're dealing with things like crystals, the crystals can also be dielectrics, okay? But now you might have some inherent crystalline lattice constraints on how things can move. And it may well be that you could have an external electric field in this direction and an induced electric field that ends up being in some strange sort of other direction. So it turns out that life becomes superbly miserable for you now. You can no longer have this nice linear approximation. You have to actually use tensors. You have to go to a much more complicated mathematical analysis because basically everything can go all different directions and you have to have that kind of freedom in the problem. So that is, I think I hit that in graduate school electromagnetism. Just a little heads up that life is not always so simple. So you certainly will find, and it is very useful in many instances to consider things as linear dielectrics. But do not make the mistake of thinking that that's all there is in this world. Because if you are now in a lab and making some approximation that this substance that you have here is a linear dielectric, it might not be. So just be aware of that. And remember that life can become very complicated. Again, as a touch of a preview, we're going to learn that light is made up of electric and magnetic fields, but as they go through substances, again, you're going to have effects due to the fact that you have a material. And if that material has certain asymmetries, you'll get some pretty weird effects on light, for example. So there's a lot of fun that can come out of this. And I do apologize. I don't mean to bust on engineers. Some of my best friends are engineers. They really are. I actually do think a lot of...
Up with your engineer. Say,
that's right. So a lot of the excitement in physics actually really comes from making it work in the real world. But I am going to bust on engineers anyway, just because, you know, it's a little bit like I took a tour of the Norfolk Navy base, and the lady who was in the Navy giving us the tour just couldn't help herself. She was busting on Marines left and right. I mean, it was just ridiculous. So there's a little bit of that going on. Okay, so next time, we're going to do currents and circuits, and just as a preview, we're going to talk about electrons in love, just so you know. All right. See you Tuesday. Have a good weekend.